This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. So hi again, it's me, John Williams, here until 1 o'clock. We go till 1 o'clock, and then Anna DeVlantis will come your way. Pete Zimmerman is the producer of both shows. So let's start here with Mark Hamrick. Mark Hamrick joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch as the Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate, bankrate.com. Hey, Mark, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, John. Thanks for having me, as always.
I want to read the first one of the lines in your in a story about you. It says, just about any angle we look at tells us that the job market is healing and healing quickly. I sort of brace myself against any good news these days because it seems like there's always a counterbalance to any good news. Is there another side to this coin, or is it as rosy as you make it sound?
Well, there's always another side, John. Otherwise, you and I'd be out of business, right? And it's really in that nuance that we try to have a better understanding of how the world is complicated. But I do think to your first point, and by the way, it's great that I'm on before someone from our Red Ventures family as well, CNET, which is now we're all part of the same big happy family. So I love that.
Yeah.
Red Ventures being our parent. The good news on the headlines of most of the jobs reports news that we're getting really is remarkably good news. But I do think that you put it in great context there in the sense of we were essentially being bludgeoned, you know, time and time again with remarkably horrible news over the course of the last year. And so much the same as, you know, just speaking personally, that I am, what, 3 days into so-called full immunity after my second shot. It's sort of like going out into the sunlight and trying to adjust your eyes again, right? And so we're trying to get adjusted to being okay with the news with respect to what's going on with the economy. And I think, you know, it's going to be within the context of what likely is going to be GDP this year that's the best since the early 1980s. We may have double-digit annualized GDP in the current quarter. I don't know when that's happened before, but it's been a long time. But, you know, there are some more challenging aspects of this, which get to the notion of supply constraints, rising prices, and the difficulty on the part of some employers finding the workers they would like to have. So just as the shutting down of the economy was difficult, this is not without its own challenges.
When we talk about something like GDP, do we have to have some context to that? That is, this year's a one-off. Of course, things are going to grow more rapidly because there was so much pent-up demand and because we just weren't able to grow the economy. So it's sort of like holding the water back and then you finally let it go. Of course, you're going to get a rush.
Yeah. And, you know, in the past where, you know, whether it was a president or, you know, a politico of some kind was saying, you know, look at what just happened. The question is, well, what happened before that and what happens next? And so absolutely need to have some perspective. And, you know, it's thought that we're basically catching up to the point that we were before the pandemic with total output in the United States essentially right now. And then the things that need to come back online in many cases do seem to be. And that is really focused on the question of spending on services and business investment. I think the business investment piece is probably still seeming to be a little bit slower because obviously you have aspects of the economy which are recovering or did already recover or never really went down. And so, you know, that's going to be uneven also by its very nature. I was encouraged to hear the CEO of Hilton, just as one metric in a television interview in the last 24 hours, basically saying, you know, in some cases, business travel's already back to 50 to 75% of where it was going to be. Because I remember in the last year, Bill Gates said something along the lines of he thought it would not recover for years and years. And so I think maybe life is going to be more similar, at least in many ways, to what it was before the pandemic than what we thought. But the other part is, John, I think this is very important. We had first quarter productivity reported this morning, and it's not important for the purposes of this discussion to talk about what exactly that number was. But, you know, we had all kinds of innovation either embraced or forced upon us during this time. In the case of like doing meetings over video conferencing software, people had to come up with that solution quickly. You know, we think about if we had had to basically go to our homes to work 20 years ago, it would have been virtually impossible. We didn't have broadband and very few people were carrying laptops who needed them. So we've had all these productivity improvements embraced and adopted, you know, at a rate that we would have never necessarily even expected. And businesses have done that across a broad spectrum of their activities and businesses. Think about the restaurants that had to figure out a way to be able to accept delivery and takeout. And that's going to give us some real benefits going forward.
We had an economist on a little while ago, Mike Miller from DePaul University. He was talking a little bit about the labor shortage and that those laborers, potential workers, have some leverage now, don't they? They can demand a higher wage if you want them to come work for you. And I wonder if that's going to, I wonder if they'll come out ahead. That is because now goods and services will cost more and they will have to pay those higher prices. I wonder if they actually come out ahead or how the math on that works.
Well, inflation is usually seen as a game that nobody tends to win very much from, but we do want to see wage improvements for workers without having runaway inflation. And it was interesting, as you may have heard among the sound bites that emerged from the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders gathering last weekend, was Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, obviously representing stewardship of one of the more multifaceted businesses on the planet, basically said price increases are being basically put through and they are being accepted. And he was basically saying that of the businesses where he's operating, where the price increases are being requested and there's essentially no other choice. But, you know, whether that's sustainable, that's the gazillion dollar question. In other words, whether we have a sustainable or continuing inflation problem. Federal Reserve doesn't think so, but they could be wrong. They've been wrong before. But we hope they're not wrong to some extent. And to the extent that workers have more, I'll use the word bargaining power. I don't know how much bargaining actually happens, but no one can essentially force one to go to work. And so you do have some choices to make if you're looking at multiple opportunities or even offers.
Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate. Nice to talk to you again, Mark. Thanks for your help today.
Always my pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, likewise. Ian Schur joins us once again on the Wintrust Business Lunch. He's a editor at CNET. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing?
Pretty good. I heard you on with Steve Bertrand on Chicago's Afternoon News yesterday talking about the president is going to continue to be banned, the former president, from Facebook. Is the most critical part of that conversation, was he banned because they didn't like his politics or was he banned because they didn't like what he was saying? Would they have banned a Democrat that long from Facebook? Would they have banned somebody whose thoughts were more aligned with their own? If that person had the, would they have banned that same person for the same thing?
I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment. I don't know the answer because obviously it's hard to put a Democrat in the same position as having stirred a mob to go and attack the Capitol, kill five people, and then encourage them further by saying, "We love you, remember this day forever." But I have a feeling that if it were a Democrat, they would treat them very similarly. And part of the problem that exists within that question is that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, you name them, they have not had consistent policies. It's very opaque. It's very hard to tell what their rules are, especially with powerful people. You and me and everyone else listening, we would have been kicked off of Facebook long ago if we posted all the stuff that President Trump did. But because he was the president of the United States, he was effectively given a free pass. They lowered their bar for him. And the reality is that when the Facebook Oversight Board, which is, I like to call the Supreme Court of Facebook, right? They're supposed to kind of figure out if Facebook is living up to its ideals and its policies. They said they agreed with what had happened on January 6th, kicking him off. They said that the imminent threat of harm was real, and it made sense to remove him at that point. Never mind that that's not, I mean, the absurdity of removing the president of the United States, the world's most powerful man, from Facebook is an idea that makes sense. But furthermore, they said the biggest problem is that Facebook doesn't have consistent policies. So they said, you need to go back. You need to spend the next 6 months, and you need to come up with consistent, fair, and transparent policies that we can point to, that mm-hmm. everyone has to follow, president or not. And that will then determine how President Trump should be treated.
It also begs the question, should you treat a president of the United States different than an average user? Give them a little more opportunity to say outlandish things or incorrect things because they're the president. We should know what they're thinking.
Yeah, that's what Mark Zuckerberg had said to defend leaving the account alone for so long. I mean, a lot of people looked at the violence of January 6th and then the social media network's response afterward and said, wow, it took five people dead for you to do anything. Thanks. And I think that what's interesting is that they had argued for many years that, hey, we do deserve to know what's in his head if he wants to share it. But I think part of what's interesting is that the board, right, again, these people who are supposed to hold Facebook accountable, they include free speech advocates, they include all sorts of different legal people and all sorts of stuff. They tend to err on the side of free expression, so they would have been mm-hmm. more likely to give President Trump his account back. And they said, look, we understand the threat that existed on January 6th, but on top of that, we believe that world leaders should be held to a higher standard than you and me, not a lower one. And I think that was an interesting thing, too.
Have Twitter numbers gone down, users or followers?
It's hard to tell. Facebook, you know, Twitter doesn't actually post that kind of data anymore. They stopped sharing it a few years ago. All signs point to them doing fine, right? Despite President Trump having said that they're failing. And Facebook, as we all know from their most recent financial reports, they are doing spectacularly, despite the fact that everyone seems to hate them.
Yeah,
so things seem to be okay in tech land.
Is it okay for the president has a new some sort of social media platform? He's got some sort of blog, and now he's telling people to post his stuff on these platforms from which he's been banned. I wonder how they'll handle that.
I do, too. I think, honestly, you know, one of the things that I've always found fascinating about President Trump is that he takes a lot of those tactics of the people who like to thumb their nose at authority on the Internet, and he really uses them intelligently. And one of the things that he had to deal with Twitter when his account was suspended, they said, you can't take over anyone else's account or we're going to get rid of them, too. And he tried. He tried to take over an AIDS account. That AIDS account was completely taken away from Twitter. Then he tried to use the POTUS account. It was shut down. The White House account, that was shut down. And then he stopped. And now he said, all right, fine, I'm going to up the ante. All of my followers are going to tweet for me, and you're going to have to remove every one of those, or you're going to have to decide not to. It's a really fascinating way he's trying to do this.
Surprising number of EV owners have switched back to gas power, electric vehicles versus gas. I didn't see that coming.
I didn't either. But when you dig into the study, which is from the University of California, Davis, the school that was right near my school, my alma mater, Santa Cruz, the thing that they found was that between 2015 and 2019, that's when the survey happened, they found that a large number of people switched back to gas because they didn't feel like they had enough charging capability outside of their home. And I think that's really important. There are two things that make owning an EV very tough these days. Even though Ford and GM and everyone else is super on the EV train, it's that it takes a while for it to charge up, right? Only Tesla has these super fast chargers that will, like, have your tank in 30 minutes, which is amazing. Other ones, it takes longer. The second thing is that they also, there aren't enough chargers everywhere. They're getting there, right? And Tesla has shown that they have enough superchargers to make it across the country now. But people still have what we call range anxiety. And that is what it sounds like, right? They're afraid their car won't go far enough. And until that is fixed, it's going to continue being a problem. One good news, though, is that President Biden's infrastructure plan includes installing a ton of EV chargers. So this may be a moot point in a few years.
I was thinking that. Eventually we'll get to that place. We're just maybe not there now. Ian Schur, editor-at-large at CNET. Well done. Nice to hear you here and elsewhere. Thanks, Ian.
Absolutely. Take care. Have a good day.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. So you've heard a lot about workspaces and shared spaces. You haven't heard it all. Here's a different take on that. It's a place called Firm Space, new in Chicago. Anish Michael is the CEO of Firm Space. Firmspace.com is their website. Anish, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
You sure this is a good idea, right? You know, the real estate downtown is plenty. You know, you're competing not just with other people in that space, but also empty office space, period. So how is it that you are venturing into that space, if you will?
Yeah, John, great question. I think we're really excited about being in Chicago. We're bullish about the market and about our product. Just to tell you a little bit about Firm Space, we're essentially a flexible office provider for business professionals. Our environment focuses on privacy, security, and support for these professionals. We like to call it pro-working, professional working for our business professionals. And we're bullish because we think that there's a need in a market like Chicago, just like we're seeing in some of our other markets, where there's many business professionals that are looking for an environment where they can ultimately focus on their work, but with the privacy, security, and support that they're looking for without the hassles of running their own space. Mm-hmm. So that's really our focus.
And, you know, what my opening gambit notwithstanding, I think it does make sense, doesn't it? A lot of us may want to go back to an office that just isn't going to be there, and we don't want to stay at home forever. We got to get out of the house. So where are we going to go? And it sounds like that's where you are.
That's exactly right, John. I think the work model is shifting a little bit. Obviously, flexibility is the name of the game. A hybrid mode is also something that people are looking to, and we offer that opportunity for folks that are looking for whether a few days a week or having something that's more flexible on a more consistent basis. Our product provides that flexibility.
And you are you a little different from some of the others in the field in that I would have, tell me if this is right, I would have my own office or space, right? It's not communal, it's not shared.
That's correct, John. All of our memberships are based on private offices and having a private office. We're a little different from the traditional co-working model in that we don't offer communal spaces where you're sharing tables with others. You do have a private office that you'll be able to go to and shut your door and focus on your work.
You also advertise five-star amenities. I didn't know that. We'll just talk a little bit about that. How important is that, and what do you provide in that area?
Well, our amenities can range from just having best-in-class technology from our IT infrastructure to our internet capabilities to our beverage services to our local services that we would provide based on the locations. We're really trying to provide an environment where our business professionals have to think less about being productive and focusing more on the task at hand.
Well, I'm just reading from some of the information about your place: private workout and shower facilities, a mother's room, echo garden, rooftop terrace and bar, golf simulator, on-site parking, bike racks. Is that all pretty common in your workspaces?
Very much so, John. It's certainly part of the amenities we look for as we're looking for space in various buildings. The things that you mentioned are what attracted us to 145 South Wells. Those are the types of amenities that our members are seeking as part of their everyday work environment. So we're excited to be able to offer that at this building.
So you're in the Chicago Loop, you're downtown, you're near the Quincy L stop, so that's kind of central part of the city. So how's business going? How long have you been there? What's the occupancy rate?
Great question, John. We're actually just going to be opening here soon, where our soft opening is next week, and we'll be officially open for business here towards the end of the month. So excited to be able to be launching in Chicago here in the coming week.
Do you price it per square foot, or does everybody pay the same rate? How does that work?
Now, pricing varies based on whether you have a one-person desk in your office or a multi-desk office. We also have great exterior offices with wonderful views. Prices for a starting one-person desk is at $549 and can vary from there depending on your needs.
$549 a week or a month? How does that...
$549 a month, John.
Huh. It's a little less than I thought, to be honest with you. I would go $600 if I were you. What do you think of that?
Well, maybe we should bring you on board to help us out with the pricing. I think that would be great. But we're certainly wanting to be as aggressive as we can in the market, and we're looking to fill up the space here in the coming months and are offering some great promotions, and excited to have your audience come check us out.
Anish Michael is the CEO of FirmSpace. That's what he wants you to check out, firmspace.com. Okay, Anish, well done. Thanks for your time. Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
12:43 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news now. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The CEO of Chicago's base camp is apologizing to employees for the upheaval caused by a new policy banning political discussion on the company's internal software. But Jason Fried says the policy will stay in place. In a blog post, he says the policy could be refined and clarified, but offered no specifics. Nearly a third of Basecamp's employees left the company when the policy was announced. Taking buyouts caused a backlash inside and outside the company. United Airlines expects domestic leisure travel to return to pre-pandemic levels this summer. The airline's chief commercial officer has told analysts to expect an inflection point in mid-June. He expects planes to be 80% full or more, with domestic leisure fares at or above 2019 levels. We're on the road to recovery, he told them. One industry expert says online searches for air travel in March topped pre-pandemic levels. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The business of food, and Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. Let's begin with Mr. Al Pacino, if you don't mind, playing the role of Jimmy Hoffa.
If you got it, a truck brought it. If you got your food, your clothing, your medicine, if you got fuel for your homes, fuel for your industries, a truck brought it.
That's from the movie The Irishman, and the trucking industry is just as important now as it was during Hoffa's era, maybe more so as the economy comes back to life. But along with earlier discussions with John Cho today, there is a shortage of truck drivers in the United States. The American Trucking Association estimates there was already a shortage of about 61,000 drivers before the pandemic, and COVID-19 made it difficult to train new ones. One possible solution being bandied around is lowering the age at which men and women can become truckers. Right now, you have to be 21 to drive across state lines. There, just about every state allows 18 to 20-year-olds to drive within state lines, but not across. There is bipartisan effort in Congress to change that. There's also no shortage of opposition to that. Farming can be a real pain, literally. Ask Robert Nord, a farmer and rancher in North Dakota. He was out checking one of his cows that had just calved, checking to see everything's okay. Now, cows are very protective of their newborn. And even with all of his years of experience, Robert got caught, knocked down by the cow, broke his back. And then a few weeks ago, he had to have his gallbladder taken out. There's a lot of work to be done, planting and all that. To the rescue came Farm Rescue. It's a group of volunteers that started in 2005. It's now present in 7 Midwestern states. Hundreds of volunteers get out there and do what the name implies. They go to the farm and do the work. Yesterday, they planted corn for Mr. Nord. He said it's hard to put in words what it means. It's a blessing. Farm Rescue helps on average 50 to 75 farmers and ranchers every year in similar ways. Chicago Board of Trade, wheat right now is up a nickel. Beans are up 24 cents. Corn is trading 10 cents higher. That's your money and the business of food on 720 WGN.
This is Small Business Week. Elliot Richardson does. He's the co-founder and president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. He joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Elliot, thanks for saying hi. How are you today?
Hey, John, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well. Hope you're doing good, too.
I am, although I note you said that now is a crucial time for Illinois elected officials to enact policies that will help Illinois small businesses recover from the pandemic. We've been hearing so much cheery economic news. Is it still really tough for small businesses?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of small businesses that are still struggling, John. And this is a crucial time for them as we head into the summer to do everything possible to keep their doors open and then recover from the pandemic and then thrive into the future. So, look, we're coming out of the pandemic. It looks like that. That's great news. We're getting people vaccinated, and that's good. But there are still a lot of businesses that are hanging on by a thread that didn't get nearly enough relief the first time around. And this is a crucial time now for politicians in Springfield and our state to take action to make sure businesses make it through the summer and then prosper in the future.
What are you talking about? What specifically do you want the legislature or the governor to do?
Well, we're pushing legislation that would allocate 25% of these federal relief funds that are coming into the state, and they are billions. I mean, these are substantial funds coming into the state. Allocate a portion of that for businesses with 50 or less employees, and then let's get some grants out to all of the businesses that didn't receive those grants. And there were a lot of them the first time around. So when Illinois stood up the Business Interruption Grant Program, you've probably got a lot of listeners that applied because about 40,000 businesses applied and about 9,000 businesses actually got grants. Let's get some more money in the pot for these small businesses. And I mean small businesses so they can pay rent, so perhaps they can bring back their employees, they can buy some inventory and get themselves back on their feet. So that's one of the things we're pushing.
Who got pardon me, I just wanted to ask you something about that. In the last rounds, do you know who got the lion's share? Did it go to the Caterpillars or Boeings? I'm thinking about some of the major employers in our state. Is that where a lot of that money went, or what? Who are you competing with, I guess, for these funds?
You know, they didn't go to big businesses, but there just was not nearly enough money to hit all of the businesses that needed them, and it was a process that was discretionary. And, you know, some business got, this has got $150,000, John. A lot of businesses got zero. So it was really the way that they were allocated that was problematic, and there just wasn't enough money, frankly, to help all of the small businesses that needed this help. And, you know, big businesses had the resources to sustain themselves through this pandemic. It was the small businesses that didn't have the reserves that, you know, fight every day anyways to make their business a success that really struggled.
You are also interested in a tax credit, the cost for training new employees. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, there were so many folks who lost their jobs and their businesses because of the pandemic. And then you've got businesses like technology and light manufacturing companies that are looking for employees. And you have people in industries that were devastated by the pandemic that really are not interested in going back into those fields. So, you know, what we'd like to see is legislation, and we filed it, that will help people who lost their jobs or businesses because of COVID get retrained and hired by businesses that are looking to expand. So it's a win-win. You help those businesses grow. You help the Illinois economy. And I guess there's another win in that that's incredibly important. We get people safely back to work because the unemployment rate in Illinois is still way too high.
You are an advocate of licensing reform. You probably liked that idea before the pandemic, right?
Oh my gosh, we did. You know, there's over 400 occupational licenses, John, in the state of Illinois. And it creates a barrier to entrepreneurs that want to enter a new field. It creates a barrier to small businesses that want to bring on people. You know, you need 1,500 hours of education to cut hair in the state of Illinois. And it costs a lot of money to get that education. States across the country, you read about it every day, are putting in place occupational licensing reforms to remove barriers for entrepreneurs. So we'd like to see licenses looked at much more strictly before they are put into place. you know, let's let some of these sunset, and we hear about people leaving Illinois. Let's allow people to come in with a license from another state and then safely practice that profession here in Illinois. Let's bring people and commerce into Illinois. So that's another thing we're fighting for right now.
Is there an employee shortage? We've been talking about that on the show today and the show previous to this one. What about that and what can be done?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. And this is really the crux of what the RISE Act gets to, that tax credit. If you're a light manufacturing company, if you're a technology company, before we just got on the horn, we heard about trucking companies, right? They're having a terribly difficult time finding skilled employees to fill positions. At the same time, you've got a high unemployment rate because people who are laid off in hospitality and the restaurant business and whatnot still have not been able to go back into those professions and perhaps don't want to at this point after being out of work for a year given the pandemic. So there is a lack of employees that can work in emerging sectors. And that's why what we feel is, you know, you link those companies up with people that want to be retrained and hired, and you do tackle the very real problem that a lot of companies are having right now in terms of finding skilled labor.
Where are you all then on a minimum wage or a higher minimum wage?
Well, the minimum wage debate has come. It's been there. I think it's baked in the cake at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, where we're at right now, John, is really get people safely back to work, get them into work in fields that are going to grow and expand, create jobs. I mean, it's interesting when you talk about a RISE tax credit, what that's going to do is take a little bit of money out of the coffers of Illinois' general fund for a bit. But then when you look at how long people normally stay at a job pre-pandemic, it becomes revenue neutral after a couple of years, and then it begins to generate revenue. So we really want to see Illinois enact policies that help us grow our way out of our fiscal issues, and that's what we're pushing for.
I have just about 30 seconds left, but we ought to have a Small Business Saturday more often. You know, it's a big deal around Christmas time. Any thought along those lines?
Yeah, this is Small Business Week, and every week, John, should be Small Business Week. I mean, small businesses generate jobs. They create jobs. Local businesses support local communities. We've seen the struggles in various local economies because of the pandemic mm-hmm. and because of the struggles of small business. So I'm with you 100%. There should be more Small Business Saturdays. There should be more Small Business Weeks. Let's find a way to support small businesses all the time because they create jobs.
This is that week for sure. Elliot Richardson's the co-founder and president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Elliot, thanks for your time. Good luck to all the mom and pop shops out there.
John, thank you so much for having me.